We're ready.
I apologize.
We will call to order the House Judiciary Committee at 1:32. Thank the members that are here at least for trying to get here on time. We have present Representative Green, Todd, James, and myself, Porter. We have for the committee a treat, sneak preview of a program that we will be hearing quite a bit about. It was my pleasure last night to have dinner with the presenter here that's going to give us about a 5-minute presentation on a new program in the state. I guess I should add, my wife and I had dinner with this next presenter, and she is Kimberly Martis, who is the short-lived, but hopefully from now on, director of the Alaska Native Center for Justice. Kimberly, please come forward and tell us about your program.
Sure. Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity. This really helps because it's really expensive to get to Juneau, and it just makes it really cost-effective for us to meet with this committee, and it's most appropriate. Just want to talk to you a little bit about the Alaska Native Justice Center and our initiatives. First of all, we're really a diverse group. We have a 25-person board that's comprised of business leaders from the Native regional corporations, plus the legal community, members of the Native Bar Association, the public defender, prosecutor, the FBI, and the local police, Anchorage Police. And with this cross-section board and staff, which we hope to get, I'm the only staff person at this time, we really hope to do some education about the status of Alaska Native people in the Justice Center, in the justice system. And this is what I wanted to talk to you about, is sort of our status and the need to improve our status. First of all, we incorporated in May of 93 as a nonprofit, and our overall mission is to advocate for Alaska Native people in the justice system. And that, for me as an executive director, my goal is to sort of, since the justice system is so large, unpackage that system and look, do an analysis of all of the processes and see where Alaska Native people are sort of hitting the wall and experiencing the most difficulties. Just to give you an idea of sort of our profile, some statistics from the Alaska Sentencing Report of 1992 indicate that although Alaska Native people represent 16% of the state population, we are currently incarcerated at the rate of 32%. That's the prison population. It's disproportionate. It's double of our representation in the overall state population. 43% of these convictions are misdemeanors, 39% are for sex offenses, and 50% are for second-degree murder. Only 25% of Alaska Native inmates eventually obtain probation or parole, yet the few that obtain them are revoked on pretty much technical violations at the rate of 42%. In Anchorage, for those for children or under for minors under 18, the arrests for alcohol are at 42.4%. The arrests for prostitution are at 33.3%. For those folks over 18 in the city of Anchorage, we are disproportionately overrepresented in the arrest rate. 54.1% of our people are arrested for domestic violence, child abuse, and family offenses. 29.7% of our people are arrested for disorderly conduct. 26.7% are arrested for sex offenses. 20.9% for drug arrests. 18.5% for alcohol offenses. 18.2% for murder arrests. And some of the conditions that, we're overrepresented in terms of on the perpetrator end or on the criminal defendant end, but we are also overrepresented as victims in that Alaska Native people are one of the most victimized groups in this state. 27% of the Standing Together Against Rape, it's a rape services agency, 27% of that caseload is comprised of Alaska Natives. In terms of being victims of violence, the homicide rate for Alaska Natives is 3 times higher than the national average, meaning that 45 per 100,000 Alaska Natives die by homicide. A Native man aged 20 who never marries has a 25% chance of dying violently before the age of 60. And for Native females, we are 4.5 times more likely to be murdered as the average U.S. female. These are some of the conditions that influence Alaska Natives in their encounters with the justice system. And then there are a whole array of cultural factors that also complicate our encounters and, in effect, result in unequal treatment in the justice system, as well as a sort of cultural class and cultural there's a cultural clash in the courts because it isn't as if Alaska Native people enter the system without a set of values or ethics. It just so happens that they really clash, I think, with the sort of Western adversarial judicial proceedings and values at play. There's a big clash. Commonly, some of the traditional native legal values or ethics that are at work include the compulsion for full disclosure or truth-telling is a value that many Alaska Native defendants enter the system with, which you can see in terms of confessions and, you know, Miranda rights and the right to remain silent and so forth. There's a clash there. I think Native people tend to be, you know, oftentimes confess without representation. Another real important legal value that we enter the system with, a Native value, is our non-interference or non-confrontation. There is a value placed on not interfering with other people's business and minding your own business. Another one is just avoidance of conflict. And so, you know, the conditions, victimization, incarceration, all of these things are at play, and it's very complicated. And the Justice Center is sort of at a historical moment in a sense, because this is the first time that the Native community has organized and concentrated its resources on justice system issues. We have a history of addressing economic issues through the ANCSA regional corporations or tribal governments, and in almost every sphere and every field, this is the first time that that the Native community has collectively we've visited these issues, I think, in the past in terms of having Bush Justice conferences and some focus on rural justice issues. But in terms of sort of addressing the whole system, the whole justice system, towards the goal of improving our status, this is something that, you know, is a first-time effort. And we really can't do this without the cooperation and support of the state justice agencies. And this is why I wanted to just sort of familiarize you with what we're up to, because we're in the process. I mean, this is about my fourth week of work, to tell you the truth, and we are just in the process of identifying the justice agencies that are going to really, that we really need to work with, the public defender, the prosecutor, the various personnel. Towards this end, we've taken a leadership position, I think, to advance some programs. We're in the midst of some fundraising, and our strategy right now is to, you know, not put all our eggs in one basket. We intend to work with the business and legal community, which we have a lot of representation from on our board. We have I'm going to make a presentation immediately after this to the AFN Board of Directors and ask for some corporate sponsorship. We're going to be applying for the Council on Domestic Violence Victims Assistance Grants coming up very soon. And we're trying everything, and we would really like to, you know, be supported in our efforts because, you know, we're the ones, I think, that are in a position to design the culturally relevant programs that are so lacking, and we have the knowledge and the resources to do that. But I think that we need some support, and there needs to be some partnerships developed. And this is sort of my message to you, is that we would like to establish a relationship with state leaders and towards this goal, of this partnership goal, because, you know, it makes great economic sense to explore alternatives such as the Justice Center. And, you know, I mean, what it comes down to is, you know, not acting and just continuing to subsidize, you know, the wholesale warehousing of a great part of our population without any alternatives or innovations. It costs more to revoke people on probations. It costs more to put people through trials that where they're not getting effective assistance of counsel. It costs more, the recidivism rate, you know, these problems are a drain for the whole state. And, you know, we need to look at not doing the same old, same old, and really become innovative in providing a sort more culturally relevant response. We need to develop culturally relevant rehabilitation programs and release planning for Native inmates who are released into, say, a city or urban situation, who have never lived in the city of Anchorage, who are straight out of the village and are expected to be rehabilitated and be a good probationer. And these are the type of challenges. Without taking too much attention, we do not believe the death penalty is an innovative solution for these problems. We think that that would be a quick fix. We feel that we would be most vulnerable, because the system as it is, in our opinion, in need of a lot of work and investment and commitment. And we really feel strongly that we've taken a public position on that issue. That's one of the more, you know, as you know, one of the more pressing issue, justice issues. And we feel that if that were to go out to a vote in terms of advisory vote, that, you know, it's very difficult to get the Native vote out as it is for just gubernatorial and national elections. If we have to organize a campaign to get Native people out to vote for, you know, on that issue, it would just be extremely difficult, and our votes would be very diluted. So it is our hope that if we can get some operational funds very quickly, that we would like to do about 5 different programs. One would be to have Native Justice Advocates working with the public defender to assist and navigate the system and fill the cultural gaps that exist between a public defender and their client. And then on the other end, the victims assistance end, we would want to work with the traditional victims assistance in the prosecutor's office and also coordinate with the police at the crime scenes, especially focusing on domestic violence problems. The other project we're interested in doing is a legal education, a Know Your Rights campaign, multimedia, radio, television, bilingual, bicultural type of campaign. Third program would be very cost effective, a pro bono program that would sort of fill the gap between Alaska Legal Services, who is really limited in its funding and I guess under a real great threat right now in terms of its future state funding. You know, I think 60% of the clients of Alaska Legal Services are Alaska Natives. What we are hoping to do is get volunteer attorneys from the Native Bar Association and the bar at large to really to represent people who really need representation but can't but fall in the cracks. They're not eligible for legal services, and also reinvest people who are able to say secure attorneys reinvest that funding through the Justice Center, put that money towards people that can't afford the service. And then the fourth project we'd like to do is be a clearinghouse and a preserver of the alternative dispute resolution entities that are alive and well in rural Alaska. The Alaska Judicial Council did a huge survey on sort of the mediation trend in Alaska and came up with a whole range of Alaska Native inventions sort of in the area of alternative dispute resolution. And fifth, we are really interested in, for the first time I'd say, working on policy issues in the working groups, say in corrections and working on alternative punishments and these sort of things. It seems to me that the justice agencies are really not in denial about a need to take some proactive type of action. The public defender, the prosecutor, the judicial council, the Alaska Bar, the Native Bar are all in support of our efforts, and we're developing really good relationships with those entities. I think that's about it. I just wanted to sort of give you a little profile of the Justice Center and let you know that, you know, we're here for the long run, hopefully with some support.
So. Kimberly, thank you very much. I know that you have to run, so please keep them short. Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I really do want to applaud you for your efforts and wish you all the success that you can enjoy with your efforts.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
It doesn't take an awful lot of contemplation to recognize the challenge in front of you, so good luck, and we look forward to hearing back from you as the program develops.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thanks for your time.
Okay. We'll now get right into the schedule. The HCR 28 consideration is going to be held until Friday, and we've just recovered the stolen chair, so Judiciary Committee is working out as it should. The first bill for consideration is HB 349, Civil Commitment of Sexual Predators. We have with us the sponsor, Representative Parnell. John, welcome. For the record, we are teleconferencing, I believe. Although my lights aren't turned on, James. Should they be?
Pardon me?
No, I'm... No? Well, whether I've got lights or not, we're on, and we're teleconferencing with Anchorage, Bethel, Ketchikan, and Nome. And with that, Representative Parnell, welcome, and please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I will just present a brief outline of what the bill does. We'll leave it to some people here who want to testify, and perhaps by teleconference, in terms of the specific necessity or need for the bill. In short, HB 349 is an act providing for the civil commitment of sexually violent predators. The bill recognizes that there is a specific group of people who do not fall within the conventional civil commitment system. That civil commitment system are people who get committed to places like API. Typically, the limit is the time frame is a short time frame. The treatment needs of this population that we're dealing with, the time frame for treatment of this population is much, much more lengthy and extensive than the typical civil commitment procedures are designed for. So what we are doing is setting up another category of civil commitment procedures for this group of people. The bill recognizes that there is a group of people with a personality disorder or mental abnormality that would predispose them to sexual offenses. It recognizes that these people are entitled to treatment and should be confined as well. Those two ends are served by the bill. In short, what the bill does is, in most of the cases that you'll see under this bill, a person who's committed a sexual offense has been incarcerated at the Department of Corrections. 3 months before their incarceration is about, before their sentence is about to end, Department of Corrections will send a notice to the Attorney General's office telling them that a person who may fall within the definition of a sexual predator is about to be released. The Attorney General's office then makes a determination whether they intend to petition for a civil commitment. If they do decide to do that, they file a petition with the Superior Court. Within, I believe it's 72 hours, there's a probable cause hearing held at which the individual has a right to be present. If there is probable cause to believe that the person is a sexual predator, a hearing is then scheduled for 45 days within the date of the from the filing of the petition. At the hearing, the person alleged to, not alleged, but the person who is, that the AG's office is attempting to commit, has all the attendant constitutional rights of a trial in the sense that they have the right to counsel, they have the right to an independent examination. The Attorney General's office has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this person is a sexually violent predator under the Act. Once that is established, if it is established, that person is then transferred basically to the custody of Department of Health and Social Services for custody, care, and confinement. There are some questions that commonly come up, and that's the basic overview of what the bill does. But one of the questions that comes up is there a mechanism in the bill to prevent confinement for life? You know, are we talking about life sentences here or not? The short answer is there is a mechanism in the bill that provides for annual examinations. The person who is committed has the right to petition on his or her own to the court, and at that hearing, once again, the burden of proof beyond reasonable doubt falls on the Attorney General to show that they are not a sexual, or to show that they are a sexually violent predator and should still be committed. A couple other questions that have come up is how many people are we talking about? The Department of Law estimates that of the sex offender population or other prisoners who may fall into this, the scope, Department of Law estimates they will prosecute 2 to 3 individuals per year. How much will this cost? The fiscal notes should be in your packets, but those will vary. When the Department of Health and Social Services presented their fiscal note, they were predicting about 10 detainees per year, and I have asked them to revise the fiscal note if it's necessary, and we'll be hearing from Health and Social Services today on that issue and on several other issues. What about the constitutionality of the bill, and what areas of the Constitution do we have to be concerned with? Obviously, one of the primary areas is the right to right to liberty and whether a person should be confined after they've served their sentence for a crime. And HB 349 is modeled after a Washington Sexual Predator Act, a portion of that act, which has been challenged in court on this ground as well as a few other grounds. The court there found that where the state has a compelling interest in treating and confining these people based upon their mental abnormality or personality disorder, and based upon their dangerousness to society, based on those two prongs, that the civil commitment procedure in Washington has been upheld and has been found to not to violate the constitutional prohibition of taking of liberty. Also, the court did note, and I wanted to backtrack a little bit, because they did find fault with several aspects of the bill, or of the Washington law. One of those aspects was in Washington they had an ex parte proceeding to determine probable cause. That just meant that the Attorney General, when they were going to file a petition to commit somebody and had to show probable cause, the judge did that with the prosecutor in Washington. In our bill, we've remedied that by providing the potential detainee the right to be present at the hearing. Another concern of the Washington court was whether they stated that the court had to consider less restrictive alternatives to confinement than locking somebody up in a secure mental health facility. We've incorporated that requirement into the bill. The court will factor that in. And of course, if the person is dangerous, the least restrictive alternative will be one that will prevent them from reoffending. It, however, will also have to be a place where these people can be treated as well. I think I think it's important here to recognize, and I just want to reiterate, that we are, because one of the most hotly contested issues of this bill is, aren't we really locking people up for their dangerousness? Aren't we really locking them up because we don't like sex offenders? And I think that there is some merit to that argument in the sense that we are focusing, on the one hand, on the dangerousness of these people, but on the other hand, we are recognizing that these people, number one, need treatment and need to be protected from themselves, and so the state is doing that in accordance with its rights to do that. I think at this point, what I would do is just, and it's up to you, Mr. Chairman, if you'd like me to take questions on the bill right now, or if we could hear from other members of the public, and then I'd be happy to stay and answer questions.
Great. Thank you, Sean. If that, with the permission of the committee, that's probably the best approach. We have four people to testify, and if you can stay, then...
Yeah, I also believe we have the captain from the Anchorage Police Department online who may wish to testify.
He's one of the four.
Okay, thank you.
We also have Margot Knute with the Department of Law here that is familiar with the bill if we get into those kinds of questions, and I already have found one, so hang around. And...
Yes.
Okay, fair is fair. We'll rotate back and forth between Juneau and Anchorage, and since we're in Juneau, we'll start with Deborah Smith. Deborah, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Deborah Smith. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Mental Health Board. Thank you for this opportunity to testify today on House Bill 349. The Mental Health Board, as one of its functions, reviews legislation that pertains to the mentally ill, and we have a responsibility to let you know what the board's feelings are on those bills. I realize that normally we are not in contact with the Judiciary Committee, but I just thought I'd let you know that. The board did meet earlier this month and reviewed the original House Bill 349. They've not looked at the committee substitute. And they had several comments about the bill. One of the concerns of the board is that there needs to be a way to make a distinction between those sex offenders who can be rehabilitated and those who cannot. Our real concern with this bill is if it is a lock them up and throw away the key, then that's not mental health treatment. That's protecting society at large from people who we don't necessarily want to have in close proximity to our children and our loved ones. But there are some categories of sex offenders who can be treated. We know that. But what we have found is that what sex offender treatment is occurring in the prisons is not necessarily appropriate for some population groups. And a good example of that are the sex offenders who are developmentally disabled. The treatment that's going on in corrections right now is not appropriate for them. So they're actually being dealt with outside of the correctional system once they get out. But if you have this bill in isolation without looking at the whole spectrum of sex offenders and how you're going to treat them, then you've just done one little dot in a very long line of what needs to be done. If you have sex offenders who are sentenced, go through their time in prison, and never receive sex offender treatment because you don't have enough treatment available in the prisons, then they're going to be out on the street and there's the real high chance of reoffending. So our suggestion is you look at the whole spectrum. You look at sex offender registration, you look at the treatment that's currently going on in the prisons, and then this then could become part of that spectrum. Yes, it is based on the Washington state law, but the Washington state law has a lot of other pieces to it too, as a real good sentencing diversion into treatment for those who are at low risk of reoffense. So we encourage you to look at that whole spectrum. Remembering that the function of the correction system is rehabilitation, and that's what we assume it's supposed to be. We also have a problem with the fact that the fiscal note that the department has put forward is out of the mental health trust. And if this is not a treatment program, if this is locking them up and throwing away the key, it's not an appropriate use of mental health trust money. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions? Just an observation. You're right. The administration of the penal system by our Constitution does address rehabilitation of the offender. It also addresses protection of the public, and I think that's part of the emphasis for this bill. Thank you. Representative James?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have one comment, and I've been investigating the way that Washington State deals with their sexual offenders, and you're right, there are more pieces, and I'd like to get some of those pieces in our legislation here, too. So I appreciate that comment that you had.
Thank you. Next, in Anchorage, covering up my microphone there, Is Captain Shirley Warner available?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am Captain in charge of the Patrol Division for the Anchorage Police Department, and I've been an officer for 18 years. I'm also co-chair of the Anchorage Task Force on Sexual Assault, and I'm here on behalf of the task force and of the Anchorage Police Department to support House Bill 349. First of all, I'd like to say the task force is made up of multidisciplinary groups consisting of members from law enforcement, the social services, victims agencies, corrections, and the district attorney's office. We encourage you and plead for your help in protecting victims and potential victims of sexual assault. I've heard testimony in the past from treatment experts that perpetrators of sexual assault cannot be cured. I have had some of my own professional experience that recidivism with sexual assault perpetrators is extremely high. These perpetrators have already ruined one of our lives, and I'm asking for your help in protecting others who may be victimized by sexually violent offenders. We currently have one perpetrator who has served his jail time, and he had committed a violent sexual assault on an elderly lady in a wheelchair. He has been reported in the past 2 or 3 weeks to be stalking a woman who worked for the Department of Corrections at the time. I feel that this is a perfect candidate who would fall under House Bill 349 and who ought to be taken a look at. He is out and about. I'm very nervous about him being out in the community. I am, we'll try to protect this woman the best we can, but it's a very scary situation that he is out there. I watched a tape yesterday where some sexual assault offenders were interviewed. One said that after the assault that he had committed, he actually felt bad about it, but felt like he had no control. Another one that was interviewed welcomed a drug called Deprovera in order that he control his sexual actions. I suggest that with the civil commitment, which is granted under HB 349, not only would you be helping victims and potential victims, you would be helping the perpetrators who need the treatment to stop the rape. I want these sexually violent predators off the street and support Representative Parnell and Tui in their foresight and their commitment with sponsoring this bill. Thank you.
Captain, thank you. We have one question from Representative Phillips.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Captain, did your task force have an opportunity to go through the language in this bill? Is that something that they would have spent time on, and did the committee make, or your task force, make a recommendation?
I spoke with Kathy Schindler, who is actually our committee chairperson, subcommittee, the legislative committee of the task force, talked with her today. The committee did not go through bit by bit the language of this bill. Haven't worked out any potential problems that may come up, but in essence and the concept of the bill, the Sexual Assault Task Force does support it.
Thank you.
See no other questions. Again, Shirley, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Here in Juneau, next, if we can have Cindy Smith.
For the record, my name is Cindy Smith. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. The network is a coalition of 22 nonprofits around the state that work with victims of domestic violence and sexual assault and their families. We're real pleased to support House Bill 349. We have, over the past several years, tried to focus on areas. You know, I've been working with the legislature about 6 years now, and the question is not uncommonly raised, what can we do to prevent these crimes? And we think that this bill is an attempt and would be a successful means to address several problems. First, it would prevent crimes. The information that we've developed in the state about sex offenders over the past 15 years or so and in the United States is quite extensive. And we know that untreated sex offenders have a recidivism rate somewhere, depending upon the study, of between 80 and 95%. We know that some treatment programs, not all, reduce that recidivism rate, some to as low as about 25%, some a little bit higher than that. Treatment is not a cure. We also know that there are a number of offenders who have such a severe problem and who combine that problem with the use of violence and for whom there are no satisfactory solutions. I guess I would want to use my time to bring to the attention of the committee the case of William Lang, recently convicted of first-degree sexual assault, first-degree kidnapping, and first-degree assault in Homer. Mr. Lang came to his compliments of the state of Washington, where he had done time also for a sexual offense. In Washington, there is a sex offender registration law. And so when Mr. Lang went out into the community, he was actually considered for the Washington State's sex predator classification. He had been out, however, at the time. And so it was a decision of the prosecutors that in the absence of any recent overt act, that they would not pursue him as a candidate for their sex predators. He was required to register and was living in a small area called Langley. And Langley, Sheriff's Department, published it in the paper, as they were able to do because they have a sex offender registration law. Mr. Lang didn't like that and was able, I think, through abuse of a local church group in Homer, took him at his word that he was a changed man. They brought him up to go to a local Bible college. The Langley Sheriff's Department contacted the Homer Police Department. The Homer Police Department, because we do not have a sex registration law in effect, was unable to use that information, even though they knew the guy was in town. They knew he was in town. They knew what his M.O. was. He was an extremely violent individual. And within 3 weeks of his arrival in Homer, had committed a crime using, again, the exact same M.O. It wasn't a question of if, it was a question of when for Mr. Lang. There are other people. There's Tim Seaton, who was out of jail for 2 hours before he was raping somebody again in Anchorage. There was a gentleman down here in Southeast who, within a year of the time he was released, raped his incapacitated niece. There are people out there like this and who victimize over and over again. The sex predators law is not going to fix that unilaterally. It's actually a law that's fairly specific and applies to a small number of people. But the intent is not punitive. The intent is to try to provide some treatment. So I agree with Ms. Smith, although I'm not familiar with the fact that you can only use commitment proceedings when people are only treatable, because, of course, many people, even with standard mental illnesses, are not treatable. And if they are dangerous, we commit them. So I do take issue with that particular idea. But I do agree that the idea behind this bill is to try to fix the problem. We're not successful doing that in jail. We're not successful doing it in jail because prisoners can refuse treatment, and we're not successful doing it in jail because recently it's been quite common that people on first-time sexual charges do not get enough jail time to go to treatment at all. And thirdly, most recently, we're not successful in jail because the Department of Corrections is furloughing untreated sex offenders before they ever go into the program. So that's not going to work. We think this bill will. We think that this will allow the Department of Law to find people that they know and there's a history of danger, and to take these people off the streets and to get them with some treatment and hopefully prevent them, both in the short term of the commitment, from offending again, but also in the long term through treatment. So I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have, but we urge your support for the bill.
Cindy, you know, questions? I know you're aware of this, but for the record, hopefully by the end of this session we will be able to say we too have a sexual offender registration.
Well, if we had had it, I guess my frustration is, which should be evident, is if it had passed last session. Yeah. It would have been in effect when Mr. Lang moved to Homer, which is clearly not the responsibility of this body.
Thank you, Cindy. Next in Anchorage, the director of OPA, Brant McGee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for this opportunity to testify on House Bill 349. My testimony will be brief and will touch only upon the fiscal aspect of this bill with respect to our agency. I have attached a fiscal note to this because the bill specifically requires that the Office of Public Advocacy provide that representation. And there is a better and cheaper way to provide the representation, that is through the Alaska Public Defender Agency. Here's why. First, the public defender is likely to have represented these individuals on the prior criminal charges. They represent most people charged with serious crimes in Alaska. Second, if they come to OPA, it's unlikely my staff is going to be able to represent them, because it is not at all uncommon for these perpetrators who have done their crimes against children. In that context, we act as guardians ad litem for conflict and sexual abuse in most cases in the state. So we would have to conflict the case out and pay a private attorney to do it. That's the most expensive way to do business. And I would encourage your consideration changing the responsibility for this function to the public defender agency. With respect to the specific locations within the bill that I would ask you to consider changing is on page 3, line 31, as well as page 6, line 19. There are some other changes as I would propose, I've spoken to the representative of the court system who did not believe that the court system should be responsible, as they are made starting at line 5 on page 4, for paying for extra witnesses. The court system is correct in this, that responsibility has traditionally been that of the agency who provides representation, and there's no reason why that should change in this particular case. So I encourage your review of that, but I would invite your reconsideration of the agency responsible for representation. It is clear that if you make the public defender the primary responsible agency, that my agency, because of the way my statute is written and the way that the public defender statute is written, we would come in on conflict cases. So there is no danger in not covering these individuals with respect to representation. I believe, and I think that the fiscal reality backs me up on this, simply that the public defender should be the primary responsible agency. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I certainly invite any questions as well.
Grant, thank you very much. Representative Parnell?
Mr. Chairman, if I can make a comment on Mr. McGee's suggestion.
Please.
Mr. McGee suggested that the Alaska Public Defender Agency be the provider of defense services. My sense is, and perhaps Margo Knuth could address this as well, but my sense is that that would tend to lead people to think this is more of a criminal proceeding rather than a civil commitment proceeding. And my concern, therefore, would be on the constitutional grounds that I am not trying to put these people through another criminal proceeding, and I don't want any appearance that we are doing that for constitutional reasons. And if Mr. McGee isn't concerned about that or has another concern, then I'd be happy to address it, or we can talk further about it later. But thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I might respond.
Certainly, Brent.
Here's one other reason why it should go to the public defender. The public defender provides representation in every civil commitment proceeding in this state right now. So the public defender has civil functions. Office of Public Advocacy has both civil and criminal defense functions. Both of us have multiple functions. I would certainly believe that the public defender is better able to provide representation of these individuals, not only because they are more likely to offend counsel for these people on criminal charges, but also because within their agency they have specialists who represent people in civil commitment proceedings that are, if not, certainly not the same, but they are very similar to the proceedings outlined in Representative Parnell's bill. So I guess I would encourage you to consider, I think this is a good year to consider dollars, rather than a problem with the image of the agency.
Both of us are both civil and criminal already, so I don't think that any knowledgeable person would draw any inference from the notion of the public defender providing representation.
Well, of course, we're talking about the Supreme Court, not knowledgeable people.
I'm sorry, that was an inappropriate remark. I think that for the purposes of the record, if with the information, Brent, that you've provided, that both agencies have civil and criminal responsibilities, that in the interest of reduced budgets, that it might be appropriate for the first agency to be the public defender, since they would not have to recreate an awful lot of groundwork on that. But we can discuss that when we get down to specific amendments and go from there, and have Margo's input at the same time. Thank you very much, Brent. Returning here to Juneau, we do have one other person that's signed up, Leonard Abel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Leonard Abel. I'm the Community Mental Health Services Program Administrator for the Division of Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. I am here to basically speak on behalf of the Department of Health and Social Services. Our department would be the recipient of these this new class of committed patients. And generally, we are cooperative and supportive with this procedure. We also believe that some people need to be off the street and try to protect society. And the way the bill is structured, it does also provide an avenue for at least a chance at treatment in addition to incarceration. So normally that would fit within our purview. We have had a couple of meetings with the sponsor and his staff that suggested maybe some language changes to really make it clear, you know, what this group of people really represent. Why you need a new commitment procedure is if people are not mentally ill in that usual sense in the current statute, but they do have a very severe, very disabling mental disorder that does very severely limit their capacity to function socially, legally, morally. And there is a chance that treatment is very difficult, long-term treatment, and you need very highly specialized staff to do that. We are concerned as a department about the location. Where would this treatment take place? And a lot of that still hinges on the number of people. We're still not sure how many people this would be involved. And also issues like least restrictive. We had submitted a fiscal note that looks at the possibility of needing two 10-bed, fairly secure community residential facilities, and that was based on a consideration of least restrictive, and also keep some of our other facilities like API focused in on their mission, their current mission. I've received information from several sources that maybe still are in our number estimates may be too high. But that would still be the approach that our department would propose is to use like a residential facility. We're not talking about a halfway house because I'm assuming these people will be there for quite some time. But a residential facility that would have some security measures built in. You open a window more than 2 inches for air, an alarm goes off, alarms on the doors, and staff security. As most of the violence that these people do is going to be directed towards some woman alone on the street, not a group of staff in a facility. So we simply make sure that nobody leaves without us knowing about it and take a shot at providing the care. It's still really uncertain at this point what that would cost. Our other concern is if we pick up this group of people that there also is some funding that comes with that. We do have a number of treatment programs ongoing right now that are effective with groups of people that are easier to treat, and I personally would not like to see funds removed from those treatment programs to focus on this particular population. Our original fiscal note was, my rush in him with it, but I think it was around $2.4 million, something like that, for those two halfway houses, a little bit more than that. Even if some of the numbers say that maybe it could be done for half that amount, but still, it's anybody's guess. I said we're generally supportive with those cautions, those considerations.
Thank you, Mr. Abel. Representative James?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One question, and I guess that when you try to put anything into law, you think of hypothetical solutions and things that's going to happen. But I was just questioning your 10-bed residential unit as a place to house these people. When earlier in your presentation, you indicated these are not mentally ill people. They have a condition which makes them not very responsible. But I would think that they would be a person that would not want to be confined to not having anything to do, that they would be productive in some way. While they're being protected from the people and themselves and maybe treated. And so I would be thinking confined to a 10-bed residential unit wouldn't provide much in the way of productivity from them, and I'd like to have you respond to that.
The fiscal running off by themselves all over town. You simply can't do that. This is not a population that you could do that with.
If I might follow up, and my reasoning was that in a larger institution, there might be more jobs on within the institution that could be performed by these people. That was my concern.
But, Doctor, if I could, perhaps, was the 10-bed unit envisioned as a wing on API or something like that, or a standalone?
No, it was separate, and that was anticipating, right, that we might be picking up 10 or more people per year. But all the estimates I'm hearing now is it could be significantly lower than that. I'm basically speaking for myself, and the department would back it. You can't always get clearance for things. But if that number really was very small, like the 2 or 3 people per year that some people are estimating, it is possible these people maybe could be absorbed at API, which would have that. And we're concerned about creating a very large unit that would change the planned mission, this mission we've been working on for 3 or 4 years.
Representative Green, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've heard some testimony, Doctor, from two of the people prior. One of them, I think, was from Captain Warner, said that recidivism of sex offenders is extremely high, and Cindy Smith indicated that there's a treatment but isn't necessarily a cure. And even prior to that, that incarceration would have to be over an extended period of time to do any good. All these things seem to tend to drive up the cost, and in your fiscal note, which is Secretary and the others, was that for long-term treatment? We were talking maybe 10, maybe less, but was this based over a long period of time?
Yes, I wrote the fiscal note. It was based on the assumption that was driving that was several years of placement at a minimum. So you might, after 1 or 2 years, again with a highly skilled therapist, you might begin to see some degree of change before I am a clinician, before I would say this person is ready to leave, I would want a long period of treatment.
And if I might follow up, Mr. Chairman, if it became apparent to you that there might be incarceration without treatment, is there any thought processes in this particular case that maybe mental health would withdraw their support, and then these people being treated would become be shifted over into some other kind of incarceration and then become a burden of the state? Is this, in other words, if you were going to do this, it would be for a long haul and you would be committed to a long haul, right?
Yeah, if we do that. I'm trying to figure out how to respond to your question. It would be obviously easier for our department if it was handled, you know, some other fashion through the criminal justice system. Mm-hmm. But if we are asked to do this, we are willing to cooperate and try to do the job the best way we can.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Darling?
Thank you. I'm just wondering if there's any way, and maybe this is meant more for the sponsor than for the doctor, but we've got a person who's been convicted and sentenced to prison for one of these crimes. They serve a term that might be, you know, 10 years perhaps, with no treatment in the criminal justice system, and then comes out and all of a sudden is starting to become treated at that point through the Department of Health and Social Services. Is there any possible way that we could begin that treatment at an earlier stage, so that the time that perhaps that person is done with their criminal sentence might be, you know, capable of being released to society? It seems silly that we're waiting so many years before we actually begin administering effective treatment to the perpetrator.
I think the distinction here, Representative Norland, is between voluntary and involuntary treatment. I mean, we are saying that this group of people, they are essentially being involuntarily committed for treatment and confinement. And the issue you've addressed, I mean, to me, goes to earlier life, essentially, and I'm not sure that it would be addressed by the bill itself.
For what it's worth, sex offender treatment is available in the institutions now, especially for someone who was in for 10 years. One of the problems, is, as Cindy pointed out, is one, the first offender, lighter weight sexual offenses, if there is such a thing, often get out before a regimented treatment program could be completed anyway. Or two, the individual says no to treatment and you can't force feed it. Or three, they're getting furloughed now, and that's another issue that we'll undoubtedly be dealing with. But if a person is committed under this program, which is a civil commitment as opposed to a criminal conviction, they are committed and the intent of it is treatment. They certainly will have the ability to say no, but it certainly wouldn't, if there's any gray matter there at all, one would think that they would take advantage of the situation that they were in, either that or they would be, in effect, reverting to confinement.
Reverting to confinement?
In this case, under the auspices of Health and Social Services rather than the Department of Corrections.
Although they weren't sentenced, really, to that confinement.
Well, it's the same theory, really, as a mental commitment now. An individual who is incompetent by mental health standards is, you don't want to call it incarcerated, but they are committed to an institution where treatment is endeavored. Same thing with a commitment under the alcohol public inebriate statute. The only thing that the professionals can do is try. If a person is incapable or uncooperative.
I guess my comment would be, if there's some way we can introduce this treatment, effective treatment, earlier in the process, which is why they're under the Department of Corrections, that we might be able to save some of the fiscal note. If these folks are truly are amenable to treatment and have been effectively treated and can be released to society at the end of their jail term, then we've avoided, you know, a $2 million fiscal note to some extent, and But, you know, corrections is under the gun. They, you know, really the programs there aren't very very effective, and they're not well funded. And in my opinion, this is a program that we would have to fund. I mean, this is not something that in a mandate we can give the department that they can avoid because they don't have the money, but they'll have to, because I think there'll be some constitutional problems with this bill if the treatment isn't truly available. And so if this bill passes, we're basically saying that it's pretty much a mandate upon the legislature that we've got to provide $2 million for this program. Otherwise, we'll be in constitutional problems.
Well, I think we'd certainly be required to provide what it is that the Division of Mental Health would need to provide the service. As the doctor said, it may be $2 million. It may be something in the area of half of that or even less if it's only two or three people a year. Mm-hmm. Representative Green and then Representative James.
Well, I hate to keep harping on the fiscal note, but it is a part and parcel of this, I think. And that mental health fiscal note's almost $3 million. And as you said, this was perhaps 10 or less. That's $300,000 per individual or more. Or less, depending. But I mean, we must be talking somewhere in that range of treatment per person.
If I might, Mr. Chairman, the $3 million total is for two 10-bed facilities. So in year two, you would open a second one. That was our first guess.
Okay, so
if you open one, it'd be half that amount.
$150,000 per. Which the other thing is, I'm wondering about all this series of fiscal notes. If, for example, the Department of Law shows a fairly low fiscal note, then up sharply in 1999, does that indicate that there are going to be more litigants? And I know I'm bouncing between people, but I think...
Representative Green, I think Margo can answer this if it's any different, but my belief is that reflects the fact that detainees will be requesting hearings for release, and so they'll have more... They'll not only have people coming into the HESS system from corrections facilities, but they'll also have to be dealing with petitions from the detainees for release.
Check it out. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Representative James.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I share some of the concerns that was mentioned by Representative Nordland, and the only way that, you know, that I could think of that we could implement some of those things that might be desirous is to make the criminal and the civil commitment simultaneous, in which case they will be serving out their criminal penalty and have the civil commitment at that time, so they would be forced into treatment or something. But I don't think that our law provides that for right now, there's nothing on the table that I see that is. And then same, I have the same concern as Representative Green regarding the fiscal note, and I guess I made myself clear that I wouldn't see putting on a new facility for these people, but then that's because maybe I don't understand how your system works. But in fact, to put a fiscal note such as this on such a bill as this in this year and time is like killing the bill, and I think it's a really good bill. So I'd like to, you know, request that you rethink the position and see how the fiscal note could be reduced, because this is, I believe, is a good piece of legislation, and we shouldn't let it get stymied because of an unreasonably large fiscal note. So.
Anything else, Doctor? Thank you very much. I don't believe I have anyone else within the teleconference network or signed up here in Juneau to testify, but I will ask, is there anyone else here in Juneau that wishes to testify on HB 349? Seeing none, anyone on the teleconference network that wishes to testify on HB 349? Hearing none. Representative Parnell, could you come to the table, and Margo, could you come up? We'll do our normal judiciary roundtable number. We have a sheet of amendments, I believe. Mm-hmm. Everyone has. Sean,
amendment number one, is that what you've
amendment
got?
Amendment number one.
And I believe Margo has one or two others that we have discussed that I'd be happy to share with the committee.
Okay. Why don't we just go through it? Margo?
Is there an extra set of the amendment that I could look at?
Oh, gee, you want to know that, too?
I can get one.
Thank you.
You bet. Perhaps we could go through amendment number one and discuss it, Margo?
I wonder if it pleases the chairman and the committee, I'd like to address broadly the constitutional pitfalls of a goal like this and where the legislature needs to walk that fine line to avoid them. You know? And I think that's what some of these amendments are designed to help us do.
Great.
the United States Supreme Court has said that it's unconstitutional to have civil commitments for preventative detention, that you cannot take somebody who you think is dangerous and civilly commitment just to keep them from committing crimes. You need both dangerousness and mental illness. Things start falling apart rather quickly after that because people get hung up on what's mental illness. And one definition of mental illness has been something that's treatable. And if you can't treat it, then it isn't mental illness, it's something else. And all of the civil commitment proceeding falls apart at that point. There's another group out there that says, wait a minute, you can be mentally ill and not treatable and still be mentally ill. So there's a division within experts there. We do know, or the court has said, that simply being an antisocial personality is not a mental illness. Being evil is not a mental illness. And what the court says your answer is to deal with those people is don't try to civilly commit them. Increase your prison sentence for the offense of sexual assault in the first degree and deal with them criminally instead. So to the extent one is trying the civil commitment answer, it at least needs to be premised on a mental illness that you want to develop in your record. You want to hear more about that, and it certainly helps if there's any indication that they are treatable. One of the problems you run into, and you're more likely to run into it in Alaska with our Court of Appeals and Supreme Court than they did in Washington, is they're going to say that certainly the committed person is going to argue this really is a criminal proceeding and not a separate civil commitment proceeding, and it violates double jeopardy. I was already sentenced for that crime. I got 10 years. I did my 10 years. Let me go. And again, the answer to that is the mental illness and the treatment factors, but it's the double jeopardy argument that I expect to hear most frequently. I asked our Office of Special Prosecutions and Appeals what their comfort level was with Washington's law, with all the amendments that we've suggested, and it's somewhere around 65% chance they think that it'll get shot down by the courts. But we still think that it creates another option of trying to solve a problem that we obviously have in Alaska, and we're by no means saying don't do it. We're just saying that there's such a likely, well, certainly we know the arguments are going to be made, and the greatest help for the bill is a strong factual showing of the possibility of treatment, and if you can have experts or hear from experts who tell you that this is mental illness and not just evilness and antisocial personality, that'll help a great deal. Against that background, I think some of these amendments are meant to, well, there are several things going on. One is trying to strengthen it in that regard. And then there were a couple of other things required by Washington that didn't make it into the bill that are being, there are technical problems as well that we'll get to.
Okay. It seems to me that there's an anomalous situation of if you take the approach that would seem to be cleaner cut, i.e. criminal, let's just lock him up and throw away the key, you've got all of the constitutional questions that come in from that, cruel and unusual and punishment fitting the crime and all those kinds of things. But when you try to deal with it on the other spectrum, you've got just the opposite set of considerations. So perhaps not ironically, we will be hearing in a week or two, three strikes and you're out. We get the other side of the coin, and it'll be an interesting discussion. Would you like to go through, Sean, the amendments that you've got with that background? And Representative Phillips?
Mr. Chairman, for the purpose of discussion, I'd move Amendment Number 1.
Amendment Number 1 has been moved for discussion. Representative Parnell.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to be clear for the record. The work draft is before the committee, not the House bill. Is that correct?
The CS is in front of this committee, yes.
On Amendment Number 1, it basically does what Margo says. It clarifies some of the problems that were identified by the Washington Supreme Court, as well as cleans up some language. Let me get my copy of the bill here and we can go through it.
Thank you.
one of the, if you go through it, and maybe Margo, if she wants to address the first three lines, in my view, that's cleanup language and is not necessarily substantive in nature. The primary concerns for me were the page 3, line 29.
Mm-hmm.
And this was something identified by Margo, was that once the person, within 45 days after the filing of the petition, and I'm reading at line 28, page 3, under AS 4730-818, Margo believes it's important to insert the words, and following a judicial determination of probable cause, because it's conceivable that for some reason the probable cause hearing may not have been shown, yet the statute's requiring us to hold basically a hearing or trial on the matter within 45 days. So that was an attempt to make sure we've got the 45 days plus we've got a probable cause determination.
So this would be inserted between 4730-818 and the court?
Correct. Must be zip like your amendments.
It says line 29, but it is line 27, is that?
No, it's line 29 in the 29. Work in the work draft.
29.
Oh, man,
it's this one right here.
Okay. Two more versions. Right.
The next, if you jump down one more line, because at page 4, line 5, we might as well just go through that while we're here. When the person, this is starting at line 4, when the person wishes to be examined by a qualified expert or professional of the person's choice, the examiner, that just cleans that up to use the same words as before, expert or professional, shall be permitted reasonable access. So that's a cleanup version there. Page 5, line 25, after correctional facility, the important, what came up was that a person could actually be confined for a year without being notified of their right to an annual examination and a hearing. And what this attempts to address is that the idea being that when a person is committed, they're told at that time that they have the right to petition the court for release, and they have, they'll also be getting notice within a year that they have that right as well, and a right to an annual examination. Mm-hmm. And if Margaret could address the last, actually page 7, line 31.
This is the immunity provision for the state agency and employees of the agency, and the bill currently offers immunity for any good faith conduct under the Act, and as I explained to Representative Parnell, good faith protects you from paying the dollars at the end of the judgment, but it doesn't protect you at all from being sued, going through the usually years of litigation, and on the one hand, it's difficult or unpalatable to some people that the state be given absolute immunity for its conduct. On the other hand, it's costing ARCO and soon the citizens of the state directly a lot of dollars to be defending the number of tort cases that we're seeing. And currently, for the foreseeable future, the state's a deep pocket defendant. We're always sued. And every time there's a new program to be administered from a financial standpoint, and from a, well, Chairman Porter knows better than most people that our protection for state employees has been rather low level and not satisfactory. And we've had individual employees who are always named in suits. We can't get them dismissed. It's a joint suit against them individually and the state. And going through the whole process is really no way to say thank you for years of public service to the state. And there are several ways of addressing it. One of them would be if the state would simply cover employees totally for their acts that are within the scope of employment and just take the burden off the back of the individual. That would certainly go some distance. And then you'd only have the fiscal question of the hundreds of thousands of dollars we're spending defending frivolous lawsuits. Until that measure goes through, absolute immunity, which is where all states started from, and we are just seeking the comfort ground between no immunity and absolute immunity, that at least it'll protect the state. I understand the concern of people who are wronged by inappropriate conduct, but I still felt obliged to offer it.
Representative Phillips and Representative Murray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Wasn't the bill that we passed out of here last week, didn't
Can that bill do just that?
The individual, not the state.
The same state or individual. This is dealing with the individual also.
Yeah.
No, it says the state.
Oh, employees of the agency.
And officials.
And officials. So it does address the individuals.
It does, but it also addresses the state.
All in one fall swoop.
Mr. Chairman.
President Darling?
Yeah, what about acts of gross negligence? I don't see that exception in here.
Through the chair. It's the same thing as non-good faith. They're both. Anybody can allege that my conduct was grossly negligent or not in good faith. And courts have gotten very technical about this. It no longer means what you would think it means as you sit there. It means that if I knew all of the facts that somebody else now thinks they can parade in front of the judge, and if I would have made a different decision, there are interpretations out there that say I wasn't acting in good faith. Never mind that I didn't know all of those facts, nor could I have found them out the way my job was functioning at that time. So what started off is making a fair amount of common sense, namely, shouldn't people be acting in good faith, no longer means just that. The exposure to liability is much greater. I probably could find out what the proper phrase is that would allow liability for outrageous conduct, and I wouldn't sit here and say that there ought to be immunity for outrageous conduct. I can try to go back and do that.
We've seen a number of bills come through this committee that there are exceptions when dealing with gross negligence and intentional misconduct. Yeah. That's kind of the terminology we've heard, and that could be added.
On that issue, I don't have a problem with amending the amendment to drop that particular language at this point, and then if another amendment would be offered later, once we get the language from our so what that would do is that would leave the requirement of good faith in here for now. I think it's important that the rest of the amendment get carried in at this point, and then we can discuss that issue.
Good faith would almost, the opposite of that would be gross negligence or intentional, I think. President James?
Well, I was thinking we could take any good faith out now and then maybe find something else to put in there.
Another option? Representative,
thank you, sir.
There I go.
intentional misconduct would certainly satisfy my concern. I mean, to have liability for intentional misconduct or intentional violations.
We'd have to restate it.
I think considering good faith, we should probably leave it rather than take it out and not have something in place. So if the committee has in mind, let's leave it in place now and ask for some language.
So in other words, you would be amending the amendment then?
I would be amending the amendment by deleting the page 7, line 31 amendment.
We're discussing another amendment, so if the committee wants to act on this amendment or has any more questions...
That would be the last item to be discussed on this, amendment number one.
We have some more suggestions for amendments.
But not for amendment number one.
Not for amendment number one.
Okay. Well, I would entertain a motion to delete the last conclusion of amendment number one.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if we've adopted this CS. I don't know if you want to be amending it before we've adopted it. You can't.
I think it's the CS is before us.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
I missed that, I guess. Because I not to get off the track here, but I did have a question as to what's different from the bill as it was presented to this committee and the CS, because I don't even have a copy of the bill as introduced. Or was there a HES committee?
There was a HES committee.
HES committee version. I don't know the difference between this CS and the HES committee version.
I could probably answer that in broad sense. Through the chair, Representative Nordland. The bill was exactly the Washington law, and what was missing was In re Young was the Washington Supreme Court decision that said most of the law was constitutional in that state except for, and there were several things that the Washington Supreme Court said needed to be done. And what has happened is Legislative Affairs has amended Alaska Legislative Affairs has amended the Washington law to respond to the Washington Supreme Court's unconstitutional findings.
And I can address those two points in the committee substitute. Do you have that in front of you?
Yeah, I don't have the bill.
The committee substitute, and this is a change from the Hess committee version. At page 3, line 15, it's talking about the probable cause hearing. Once the Attorney General has filed the petition, probable cause hearing is held within 72 hours at which the person has a right to appear. That is something that was absent from Washington law and that the Supreme Court there found to be a problem. It was the ex parte nature of the proceeding in Washington. So that's one change. The second change is on page 4, line 20. And I talked a little bit about this in my earlier presentation, that requires the court, on a determination that the person is a sexually violent predator, the court shall consider less restrictive alternatives to confinement. Mm-hmm. And that is a requirement by the Washington Supreme Court. That was not in the version that the Hess committee saw. I put it in the committee substitute. And those are the two basic changes that I...
Before we get any further discussion, it would appear to me that then this CS is not in front of us. What really is in front of us was the original bill from Hess. And so I would entertain a motion to adopt the CS. Would you agree? Then move that we adopt the CS dated 2894/1449/0. Discussion? Objection? Seeing none, we have the CS in front of us. Representative Phillips.
Mr. Chairman, I would request, too, that we do get a copy of the original bill to put in our files. The bill that went into Hess.
We can do that.
We can do that.
As well as Hess.
Hess bill,
but I think the original bill is introduced, not the CS.
Is it this the Hess CS?
No, this is a new. This is a third.
Oh, then both. I want the original bill and the Hess CS.
Okay. We can get that.
Yeah.
But for the record, the difference between the bill that we would have received and this CS are the two things that you've described.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. So we know where we're at. I would then, getting back to this amendment, would you like to try to get us some quick language on intentional act or?
Well, before an intentional act.
On this last line, any good faith rather than just total immunity, my sense of the committee is that they like to see an intentional act in there at least.
Okay.
In a perfect world, I would confer with Susan Cox, who's the state's head of the tort section, and ask her.
Well, we may have some of this, too. So for right now, let's just delete the last section. Representative Davidson?
I just wanted to make the inquiry. Do we have before us a candidate for a subcommittee?
I don't know yet.
I thought I made the motion to delete that already.
I thought we did.
I will recognize that a motion was made to delete from amendment number 1 the last two lines, which are page 7, line 31, after liability, delete any good faith. Is there discussion? Objection? If not, that is deleted from amendment number 1, and we have then, as amended, in front of us, amendment number 1. Amendment number 1 has been moved. Is there discussion? Objection? None. Amendment number 1 is passed. If I may, Representative Parnell and Margo, while you're there, could I direct your attention to page 4, second paragraph B, beginning on line 13. The court or jury shall determine beyond a reasonable doubt whether the person is a sexually violent predator. Okay. If the state alleges in the petition a prior sexual violent offense for which a finding of sexual motivation is necessary, to classify the offense as a sexually violent offense, the state shall prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the alleged sexual violent act was sexually motivated. Do we have a crime for which an element is sexually motivated?
Mr. Chairman, no.
Okay.
And what's going on here is all sex offenses automatically qualify for this type of proceeding. But other felonies also qualify. Murder, robbery. I looked at the list. I think it's everything in AS 1141. And what this is saying is if you are a non-sex offense offender, then we can still try to civilly commit you to this if we find that your crime that wasn't a sex offense nonetheless was sexually motivated. And the classic example is the person who ends up being convicted of murder when it was murder slash rape, and you don't have a sex offense that to rely on. So what would be required there is simply showing that, yes, the charge and the conviction was murder. The offense was a sex offense. that's a bouncing ball of definitions at the end, that, that if one follows it through, that's what it leads one to.
Also, just for the committee's referral, because I didn't mention this earlier, but your bill packet should contain profiles of the types of offenders who are confined in Washington at this point, and it will demonstrate that we are talking about the worst of the worst here. We're not talking about a whole pool of people.
Can you get this?
Dave Codd has got to present something of his own to the House committee, and we bid him fond farewell.
Good luck.
Okay, I see what it is that we're seeking here, but I've just got some difficulty with alleging that a finding of sexual motivation is necessary to classify the offense as a sexually violent offense.
Mr. Chairman, what it's saying is if the offense that's being alleged is an offense for which the finding of sexual motivation is necessary, then we have to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt. If your concern is trying to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that an allegedly sexually violent act was sexually motivated, I would certainly welcome not having to prove sexual motivation beyond a reasonable doubt. The motivation part's the hardest part, particularly when we know that rape isn't a sex crime, it's a power crime. So if you don't have sexually motivated in sexual offenses, trying to find it in non-sexual offenses is all the more difficult. So analytically, it makes sense, but in terms of practical terms, what is my burden to prove? Yeah. There's something troublesome there.
Did the Washington case speak to proof beyond a reasonable doubt in the petition hearing itself?
Other than the fact that the procedural safeguards were such, and I mean they used the stringency of the procedural safeguards, but not directly on this point.
Well, would you have to use that stringency here, I guess is what I'm... Could you not use preponderance here instead of...
I don't know. The Washington case just... Washington legislature just assumed that it was appropriate to do so and did so from the outset. What might be easier to change is the terminology. Sexual motivation is something that the Washington law used, and maybe we instead would prefer something that goes to conduct rather than motivation, where sexual contact or penetration was an objective or something like that. And I may be able to work with the sponsor in coming up with a focus of conduct rather than motivation.
That would allay my concerns of getting into a box you couldn't get out of with this requirement. Are there any other questions about the bill as amended?
Well, yes. Maybe my reading of this is incorrect, but as I read this, this is not only for releasing incarcerated people, but also for someone out there who may be judged to be a potentially violent or maybe already. And my concern is that either way, once they're incarcerated, as I read it, they have the right annually to recommend a release or, I mean, a review. And does this then lead itself into perhaps an undue burden on the Department of Law? Because there's going to be a plethora of these things every year. And it seems like it's just it's going to cost the state a fortune, even in that regard, and yet it doesn't reflect in the fiscal note.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Green, burden, yes. Undue, no. I don't know. I mean, it's not avoidable. Uh-huh. The court says that you can't lock these people up and not give them an opportunity to prove they should no longer be locked up. And I expect it's much like our residency requirements that people tried longer periods of time and it's gotten whittled back to 1 year is as long. As a matter of fact, I expect a challenge, somebody saying, wait a minute, I go in on April 1 and fail to convince you that I'm now mentally well and should be released. I have to wait 365 days in which I may, in fact, be mentally well, and I've lost my liberty for that year. So a year is as Right, right. Along a time period, as I think the courts will uphold, and it's a problem. And it's a problem you don't have when you simply sentence them. Well, it's not a problem borne by my office. I'm sure the parole board is getting its requests for release at some point. But yes.
I've got a couple of things that were brought up in the testimony. I take it, considering the discussion that we had, that there would not be any objection to making the public defender primary responsible for rather than OPA?
I still have concerns about that, and I don't have a problem with you making that change. I think it deserves a little more scrutiny because of the implications of turning it to the criminal side rather than the civil side, regardless of Mr. McGee saying that public defenders do civil commitments as well. It's just the appearance that it is a public defenders are typically perceived as being a criminal agency, and that's something I'm not a leap I'm prepared to make at this point.
Mr. Chairman, I have a problem just because of the name of it. Yes, you know, it seems to me like that they're that the public defender is there to defend the perpetrator, not necessarily to find the perpetrator needs more incarceration or any more treatment. It seems to me like the Office of Public Advocacy would be the best one.
Well, we have public defender or Office of Public Advocacy is pretty close. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm just trying to think ahead to the considerations ultimately that will be given this bill are going to be fiscal. And if we can get enough information on the record that we certainly do mean confinement, not incarceration, mm-hmm. Representative Green.
Yes. Sorry.
That we mean civil procedure, not criminal procedure. That we mean an attempt at treatment, although we recognize that is one difficult process. That we're within the constitutional requirements of making this bill meet the constitutional restrictions that obviously exist. But at the same time, I don't think that it would be deleterious with that on the record to save some money and let the public defender save 2/3 of their work by having already a record of this case.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have a problem with that. I think we've got testimony on the record that it would save money. I don't think there's any disputing testimony at this point to it. But I wanted to let's finish this topic because I wanted to go back to the treatment issue and the difficulty of treatment and
sure.
Just put a couple more things on the record with respect to that. Did you want to resolve the public defender OPA question?
No, I think there's a couple of other potential amendments. What I think that I would suggest doing, if you don't mind, is if you could make a note of these and anything else that comes up, we would hold the bill until you get us another amendment back with those on it and your best guess at what...
Me including the public defender, you're
saying? Yes. Okay. Uh-huh. You know, from your perspective.
From Department of Laws, it does not make any difference. And I think to the Court of Appeals, the treatment issue is more important than any of the other trappings. I believe that it is true the public defenders do handle all civil commitment proceedings, in which case it does make sense for them to do this as well. But they've not been heard from and might have an opinion on the subject.
President Darling?
Perhaps we could get a proposed fiscal note from the public defender agency. If they don't actually come out with a lower fiscal note than public advocacy, then...
Well, we would have to get one from them if we made that change.
But, I mean, even before we make the change and pass this bill, I'd like to know. Because we only heard from Bram McGee. We haven't heard from John Slumley.
If we can place the call. Yeah.
It would be less money.
Okay.
Yeah, that's true. You know.
That on the record, we know how John's going to respond. So.
Okay. Well, the other thing came up, and I didn't get to, when Brant was reading them off, I didn't get a chance to catch his page and line reference, but the appointment of the examiner was going to fall to the responsibility of the court rather than the agency, I believe, was what he said. And
that's the court system.
Yes, we have Chris Christensen. Come on up and pull up a chair, Chris, from the court system, and... I'll bet you that's one he could tell us about.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Chris Christensen, General Counsel to the Judicial Branch. There are three sections in the bill which were referenced by Mr. McGee. And essentially, the way we do things in this state is apparently a little different than the way they do things in Washington State. There, apparently, the judge appoints both the public defender or OPA, their equivalent, and he also picks out the psychiatrist to do the examinations. In this state, what happens is the person gets their public defender or their public advocate, then that person goes out and hires whatever expert they think they need. The expert is funded out of their budget. That way, all the costs of representation are in one agency's budget. And the way this has been drafted in several places, it says OPA shall be appointed, then it goes on a paragraph later to say the court may appoint an expert to examine. And the references specifically are on page 4, beginning at line 7, page 5, beginning at line 30.
Oh, you're on the original bill? Or are you on the work draft?
The work draft. And page 7, beginning at line 7. And I'm not sure quite how the draft will reword those, but essentially it will either provide that a person is entitled to a psychiatric examination, but the psychiatrist is hired by OPA, the public defender.
Whomever we end up with, yeah.
Okay.
Any questions on that point? Great. Thanks, Chris. Okay, Margot.